Let's go.
Are you ready to level up your journey? Welcome to Get On Top, where we dive deep into the riveting tales of self-made entrepreneurs and corporate titans who have scaled the summit of success. We'll uncover the secrets behind their huge rise. Get ready for a roller coaster of insights, inspiration, and a roadmap to elevate both your mindset and your life. This is Get On Top with Morgan Brown. Today's guest is someone who knows how to turn an idea into motion and make it unforgettable along the way. Mark Gilbert is a globally renowned director celebrated for intelligence and understanding comedy and iconic storytelling. His work has been trusted by some of the world's biggest brands, BMW, MasterCard, Kia, Subaru, Sky Vodka, brands that understand the power of clarity, craft, and culture. He's also the creator director of Start the Car, an iconic IKEA commercial that went viral worldwide. This is a conversation about creativity, momentum, and why the best ideas are deeply rooted from within. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for being here on Get On Top. I'm so excited to talk to another Vancouverite.
Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit. Of course, I deep dived you. And a lot of the stuff that I got to deep dive you is all the projects that you got to kind of work on. And I think the first thing that resonated with me so much is how you started, like how you got into this business in general. Take me back on where your kind of journey started.
Well, I had no intention of getting into film or directing. It kind of came out of the blue in the sense that I didn't study film. I didn't study photography. I was on a tennis scholarship to the States when I was 18, did that for a while, came back and finished some university in Ontario at Western, and then moved out west. A girlfriend that moved out west and followed her.
A girl brought you here.
Yeah, just came out here. And I took a job as a tennis pro at Hollybrook Country Club in West Van.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, quite a nice introduction to the city, you know, rolling
Beautiful.
Up there every morning and seeing the views and meeting lots of obviously really interesting people. And I met a fellow named Alan Davidson, who was in the creative world, and he owned a small ad agency. And so I started kind of, you know, chatting with him, and he was a regular client. So we started talking about interests and life path and all that sort of thing. And eventually I met a photographer through him named Robert Ernest, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And so I spent some time with Robert and ended up doing an apprenticeship with Robert as a photographer.
Just, oh, wow.
You know, completely, you know, complete diversion from what I was doing. But I had no intention of teaching tennis. That was kind of a A to B job for me, you know, and I knew something else was coming. So did that, apprenticed with him. And then after a couple of years, became a commercial photographer. And at the time, there was a lot of boutique agencies. Brian Fulton Shee was
yes.
in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bigger ones, you know, DDB and Cassette and all sorts of different small agencies. So I started doing commercial work with them and, you know, all sorts of campaigns and clients and products from food, you know, A&W to
wow.
the film festivals and various different things that were going on at the time. And I did that for about, I guess, 6 or 7 years and ended up working a lot in the States and I did fashion photography, I did advertising, I did a lot of portraiture for GQ and, you know, Vanity Fair type of stuff, although I didn't actually work for Vanity Fair, but you know, that type of portraiture and that sort of thing. And I had a very distinct style. I had kind of really gotten into like a very limited color palette and kind of quirky themes, people in architecture and, you know, really, really oddball sort of portraiture. And a couple of ad agency people in Toronto caught wind of what I was doing and started asking for me on projects and then requesting me to direct some television commercials. So I was honest at the time and I just came back with, you know, I couldn't turn a camera on, you know, in terms of filming a commercial. So a production company in Toronto that was just starting up was called Reginald Pike.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
And really cool company, started by a fellow named James Davis. And there was some directing teams that were there, the Plourian brothers who've come to be very, very successful in the industry. Another woman named Yael Stev, a few others. And basically, it was a small production company. And somehow in that first year or two of starting up, we rose to the top globally in terms of the work. Canada was doing really great comedy and really great, you know, storytelling. And it just took off. And so we signed a mutual contract with a company called Biscuit in the States, and all of us as, you know, Canadian directors, and not all of us, like I'm actually British born, but a lot of us were from different places, but based in Canada, started getting this work in the States and started getting work globally. And yeah, it just took off.
Well, how did you find, like, I'm stuck on this place of you going from this really kind of, you know, competitive teaching type person to a person of creativity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people are going to be listening to today have that passion and maybe drive to want to touch that, but they're so kind of, their identity has been so one way and not that way as a creative. Mm-hmm. What's your biggest piece of advice to those people that are listening?
That's a great question. I mean, I think there's always, I mean, along the way, I think there's always telltales, you know, there's things that give you a hint as to where you want to be, but you don't realize it until you look back in retrospect.
Right.
So if I think back to my university days, like I really loved acting, and I acted in elementary school and sang in the choir and did all the, all the things that kids do, you know, that may or may not be, big in your life, or you don't perceive them as being a big part of your development. You know, sometimes they're just, you know, a pastime, something that you try. I mean, I was a really sporty, athletic kid growing up, and those were things that I just did along the way. And then, you know, when I look back, I got to university and I acted, and you know, I did a lot of theater and I acted in a lot of plays. And I thought about going to Juilliard. I had a professor who was sort of pushing me to go to Juilliard and apply. And in the end, I can't remember why, but I just didn't follow that path. And then, you know, as I said, came out west and pursued other things. But, you know, when I started directing, I was probably, you know, a little bit into the path, and I kind of looked back and I was like, wait a minute, I've been an actor. You know, I spent years as a commercial photographer, and now I'm using those skills in concert to direct television commercials. You know, I work with actors. I understood how to cast. I understand how to, you know, find a location, do production design and, you know, wardrobe. You know, as a photographer, you kind of wear many hats.
You do.
So, so in retrospect, I kind of look back and I was like, you know, wow, I actually, all of my skill set has aligned for this purpose, but it wasn't intentional. And I think that, you know, a lot of people probably don't realize that everything we do really, it comes into the mix. You know, it's part of the recipe. But when you're putting all the ingredients together, you're not exactly sure what you're cooking up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know? Of course. It's funny though. I think you're right. It's like having these little, remembering that that's just like a part of your tool belt. You know, you've got all these little pieces in you that over time, years through it, you realize they're just part of the things that are just going to make you even stronger in some other field. Mm-hmm. What was the thing that just got you very excited in that creative world that kind of kept you there? Because, you know, some people might swerve into resin art, or some of them might get into that photography. Mm-hmm. Was it just like a pure passion and you felt comfortable there? Or was it a connection of, you know, I'm good at this and I think I should stay in this space? Like specifically photography, I think.
Yeah, well, photography, if I think back, I was at the end of an undergraduate degree. My intention was to go to law school. I'd studied philosophy, and that was what I was told was a great undergrad, you know, pre-law degree. And at the end of my stay at university, a friend said, let's take a photography course, you know, I think it was literally called a Charlie Brown photography course, one month, one day a week for 2 hours photography course. And honest to God, that is my only formal education in film or photography, other than on the job.
Experience.
Other than experience. So I took this course, really enjoyed it. And then it just became a hobby. And I, you know, I had, my dad, when I was a kid, had a dark room in the house. So I think, you know, sometimes when there's you have those things that you do in life and you think, yeah, I can do this. Like this is, you know, this is something that I've seen or I'm familiar with. So it didn't seem insurmountable. So I got into photography, started doing that. And then when I did the apprenticeship that I was talking about, I can remember the photographer saying to me, well, show me all your work, you know, show me everything you've done. And I think I had shot 3 rolls of film in my entire life. So I showed him the 3 contact sheets, which were, you know, clearly...
What were they up? This is
random,
my question.
Random things, you know, like my foot, you know, like, I don't know. They were whatever was within the vicinity of the camera when I was taking my first few pictures, you know, a motorcycle on the street, you know, whatever it was. So, you know, you start to build a, you know, a skill set, I guess, in strange ways that you don't expect. And
then you pick it up and you feel comfortable there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is such a good piece of advice. I think like to not be afraid to kind of do these little courses and still kind of find pieces of yourself to hopefully get there. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was, I think if I remember correctly, you know, when I came out West and I did the apprenticeship, I had a few oddball things that happened. One was that I decided to, you know, I take a break from the assisting. I'd been doing it for about 1.5 years. And a friend of mine who lived in Whistler, which is a bit of foreshadowing to where I am now, but he phoned me up and he said, hey, I'm working at a heliski company in Whistler and we need a photographer. Would you like to come up for the season and work as a heliski photographer? And I said, classic, you know, young approach to something like, I said, sure, that sounds great. I said, but you know, I've got to be honest, like I don't really ski. I've never, you know, I think I'd skied once in high school, you know.
This is hilarious.
And so he said, you know, don't sweat it. You're athletic. Like just, we'll come up, we'll teach you. So I think I skied with him twice. So I'd skied, you know, a grand total of 3 times in my life. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm going up in a helicopter with a 50-pound bag of gear on my back and skis, you know, and had no idea. And I remember pulling, there was a guide named June-san from Japan. And I still see him to this day. Lovely fellow, you know, really, really now, especially accomplished guide. And I remember pulling him aside before he went up. And I just sort of said, listen, June, like I don't really know how to ski. So any tips you can throw me, you know, would really be greatly appreciated. So he was so kind and lovely with me and gave me some tips, which luckily in powder was, you know, just kind of point the skis down the hill. You're not too far off. But I did that for a season. Okay. And then I think after that season, I decided to go and travel, you know, Thailand, Nepal, and just, you know, shoot portraiture and shoot pictures. And then I ended up doing a really, one of my favorite series of images was in Morocco. And then I did the same thing in Cuba. And what I at that point, I think I'd started to get a little bit of editorial work with magazines and things.
Beautiful.
And so I was shooting, do you remember Adbusters?
Of course.
Yeah. So Adbusters, funnily enough, they had me on some assignments. So I was, you know, working for them at the same time, working for ad agencies and magazines and, you know, kind of a very diverse collection of work. But, you know, I got used to being in foreign countries and interacting.
Getting comfortable there.
Yeah. Interacting with somebody that, you know, a random person that I would walk by and asking them if it was okay if I would, you know, take their portrait and explaining what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got arrested in Cuba because I was taking a portrait of 4 gentlemen in front of, you know, all those beautiful old cars they have. So beautiful. I was there in a rural part of Cuba. I'd sort of set out for a few days to just roam around out of Havana. And I took a portrait of these 3 fellows. And it just so happened that right behind them was a red and white tower that, unbeknownst to me, had something to do with nuclear energy or some form of power. And a policeman pulled up while we were doing the portrait. And I guess it's illegal to take pictures of anything to do with...
Like nuclear.
Nuclear, yeah. So I got taken in, got put in a cell. They confiscated all my gear and all my film, which was with me, that was my biggest concern. And in the end, I had a promo piece. I used to do these little 40-page booklets, you know, pamphlets kind of to promote myself to ad agencies and that sort of thing. And so in the end, I sort of made a trade. He was allowed to keep the book of portraits and I was allowed to leave. And I don't know if that was... Just that substantiated the fact that I was an actual photographer or whether he just wanted the portrait book, I don't know. And it wasn't a dark experience at all. It was kind of fascinating to be in the environment. I just wish I could have photographed it while I was in
the cell. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I did that. And then And then from that point on, I think I leaned more into the commercial work. You know, I started showing you at the time, you know, you would go in and promote yourself. You'd go into an ad agency, especially locally, because it's a much more global world. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, you just go in with your work, with your book and say, hey, can I speak to, you know, the...
Yeah, be whatever it may yeah, be, CEO, yeah, whatever of the company.
Yeah, the creatives creative and show director. Them my book or show a producer, you know, a print producer, you know, not that different from a motion producer, mm-hmm. motion film producer. Or so, yeah, so that happened. And, you know, I kind of just started getting commercial work and that really opened my eyes to yes. the industry. And so I started working in the States and I got a couple of international assignments and U.S. representation and that sort of thing. So I think when the television directing, you know, directing TV commercials yep. came up, it was a little more accessible for me in mm-hmm. terms of understanding advertising and working with creative teams and clients. And, you know, I'd spent at that point a few years, you know, sitting in pre-production meetings with clients. And one of my biggest print campaigns was, I believe it was for Toshiba. It's funny, I can't remember if it was Toshiba or Microsoft. I think it was Toshiba. And they had bought all of the billboards in Times Square. So in Times Square, they have, you know, obviously private billboards that are, you know, have their own brands, but then there's a certain amount of these big public billboards that, so they'd bought all the billboards in Times Square and we did a campaign and it was the beginning of the internet. So it was all of these people, you know, it would be a woman in an office and she would have a Sherpa in the office.
So
and the Sherpa would be pixelated and the Sherpa looked really authentic, you know, like he was straight from Everest kind of thing. And it was all about the internet helping you, you know, like being part of your work engine sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was all shot in LA, really high production value stuff. And I, you know, I remember sending a friend saying, like, can you please go to Times Square and
take a bunch of
pictures of all these billboards and things. So, so I got to a great place with it and, you know, and had so many cool experiences with, you know, with all sorts of brands. And then, and then when television opportunity, you know, directing commercials came along.
Where was that transition for you? Yeah.
So, I had a friend, James Bland, who runs a production company in the UK now called Arts and Sciences. He just called me one day and he said, hey, I've got a friend also named James Davis out of Toronto, who was British by birth and had started Reginald Pike, this company. Mm-hmm. That's the name kind of has a British kind of
very good name.
Yeah. Really funny name. So he said, you know, I've got this friend, he's starting a production company and he knows about your work. And it just so happened that creative team that James Davis knew in Toronto really wanted to work with me and had contacted him and the Plorian brothers, who I was mentioning, Ian and Michael, these two gentlemen that created this directing team. I'd worked with them when they were agency creatives.
Oh, okay.
So they also served as kind of a, you know, a reference for me or, you know, was part of the demand, I guess. So James Davis said, you know, listen, if you come on board, you know, I know you don't know this world, but, you know, I'll help you along.
Help you through it.
And we did some spec commercials. So we did some spots for, the first one I did was in a morgue. It was for the downtown women's shelter, East Side Women's Shelter in Toronto.
Toronto.
And it was basically a woman who was lying on a, so I'm going to get this all wrong.
But this is interesting.
What do you call it when they're
lying in a shelter? You know, yeah, postmortem. Oh.
When they've passed. What is, an autopsy. Thank you. So there was an autopsy going on and the fellow's saying something about, you know, woman. And he starts to give a description of age, you know,
of 55
or whatever. And she sort of sits up and not sits up, but somehow says her, you know, she says, you know, I'm 35 or whatever. So the whole idea was that these poor women in the downtown East Side, you know, that, you know, are actually in their 30s or 20s or whatever, you know, they've had such a hard life that, you know, on the table,
the
they appear
side.
To be old. But that one, that's probably not
that's
the best
story.
That's
a really funny story.
That's not the best story to reference. Norma, it's probably my least successful commercial of my career. But
but it was the beginning.
It was the beginning.
To kind of get you into that space where you're like, and for those people that don't understand what spec means.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of almost like a kind of entry to the commercial directing
side,
right? Yeah.
So there's no authentic client.
Okay.
Although in this case, that was a real client, but you know, it's sort of a teaser. You
it's
know,
like it's, a pro bono.
Yeah, it's
teaser.
A pro bono kind of teaser to say, hey, I can do this work, and gets put out into the world. And so a better example than what I just gave is we did Pepsi mini cans. So,
okay.
So Pepsi mini cans was a very successful campaign with a creative named Christina Yu, who ended up, she's very successful to this day, just started her own agency in Toronto with some other people. So Pepsi mini cans was this clever little campaign for these, do you remember the little tiny...
tiny little cans?
Yeah. So the idea was that the cans are small, but they're not that small. So, you know, you've got a husband and wife, and the husband's looking into the camera as if it's the mirror, and he's got a mustache, and his wife walks into frame as he's kind of getting ready and doing his thing. And she says, you know, you've got something in your mustache, and he kind of brushes one side of his mustache. And she says, no, other side. And he brushes it, and this can falls out of the mustache and lands at his feet. And then, but it's very like art directed, kind of baby blue and tan, and
ooh,
very
nice
kind of
color.
And it was kind of a quirky little world.
Yeah.
And so there was that. And then there was another one where a woman was in her bathroom, and also the art direction was kind of, you know, this kind of 70s pink, you know, peachy pink kind of bathroom. And she's clearly just come out of the shower, and she's got a towel around her head, just kind of got her finger in her ear trying to get the water out. And she kind of bangs on the side of her head, you know, to get the water. You know how you do that?
Yeah, yeah.
And this can shoots out and lands from her ear into the sink. And there's no funny tagline. It just comes up with a little super that says Pepsi mini cans, you know? So,
it's so
it's kind of inferred, you know, they're small, but they're not that small. So it was like the visuals did the storytelling and the comedy. And then we did some work for...
But those aren't small specs, even though they're specs.
No, I was blessed.
So good.
I was blessed because James Davis and Christina Yu and the crowd that I landed with, they all were top of the game. I didn't realize it at the time, actually,
how high level talent it was.
Yeah, I didn't realize my entry point was as high as it was. And the caliber of ad agencies and creatives that I was able to work with right from the get-go were top notch, you know, within Canada especially. And I ended up, you know, doing a lot of work in the States and the UK shortly after. But like another one of the campaigns, I'm just thinking, we did a campaign for, this was truly a spec spot. So we did one, it was originally intended to be for Red Bull.
Okay.
And it ended up, we did it for the brand Guru. Do you know?
Guru.
Guru, also an energy drink.
Energy drink.
So these were quite quirky and oddball. And so this one was called Get on the Bus. And it's a fellow who's outside a big kind of apartment building, very monochromatic, you know, very vast, like, you know,
big,
this big apartment. And he's this kind of downtrodden looking character in a trench coat and kind of a comb over and everything. And he's walking towards the bus, kind of trudging along, you know, and out of the building, his, you know, you would imagine his wife yells, you know, "You're gonna miss your bus," you know, and you see him look up and, you know, and he kind of starts walking. And then eventually you see him sort of get on the bus and sort of, you know,
fall,
sit down kind of thing. And then there was this kind of strange kind of roar sound that we used as an effect. And this character that we created for the delivery of the Red Bull or the Guru was this kind of like almost like the Lone Ranger kind of cowboy character with tassels. And but it was like Evel Knievel and a cowboy mixed together or something.
Yeah.
So he walks up, and as this kind of dramatic sound effect happens, he kind of presents a can of, you know, again, Red Bull or Guru. And the guy looks at it and cracks it open. And then, you know, you see him kind of arrive on the bus with all this energy and kind of like vigor kind of thing. You know, that's right. That's right. The presentation,
that is so
clever. I got it backwards. The presentation of the drink was before he got on the bus. That's right. And then you kind of cut to him getting on. So it was like the whole idea was, you know, you get this thing and then you achieve something. But the thing that the characters had to achieve was so minute,
so,
you know, he just had to get on the bus. So like another one was this massive man in a factory, like a, you know, like a canning factory or something.
Okay, okay.
You can imagine very kind of like, you know, again, monochromatic and, you know, very, I don't know, it was not an uplifting world, but it had a lot of charm and character from an art direction point standpoint. And he's this huge man, like 7 feet tall. We cast like a Andre the Giant type of character.
Oh my goodness. That's so
fun. He's getting picked on by this little skinny guy, you know, and They want him to arm wrestle. He's trying to. He's
I feel like I've seen this.
Oh, have you? Okay.
So I feel like I've seen this.
Maybe this is on my Instagram.
Maybe it's on your Instagram.
So he's trying to. The skinny guy's trying to pick a fight with the big guy, and the big guy's putting like a stack of 10 sandwiches in his locker.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so then eventually the evil Knievel cowboy comes up and gives him the drink, and the next thing you know, you cut to, you know, Andre the Giant and the little skinny guy having an arm wrestle. But in our scenario, instead of the big guy crushing him, it's like. It's like they're struggling, you know. So again, he, you know, it's a small obstacle that he has to overcome just to get the nerve up to, you know, to do the thing. So I mean, and that's the joy, and that's the beauty of advertising and storytelling is these just getting into these clever little stories that, you know, are, you know, they're just a half a page idea, and then you kind of build them and you.
What's that process like for you guys? Like, what does it look like when you're. You're working with that client or you're working mm-hmm. with that person that, let's just say it's Pepsi, and you guys get around that table and start kind of discussing ideas. Is like, what does it look like?
Yes. Yeah, so,
give us a little peek into that beautiful space.
Well, I always explain it to people as just the sequence. So you imagine you've got your clients. So you've got IKEA, you know, you've got IKEA and they've got their department. What's that?
Do they have their department?
Well, no. Well, maybe these days some of it's in-house, but back, you know, typically it's been ad agencies. So IKEA will go and they'll find an agency and sometimes become the agency of record and they'll say, hey, these are our goals for the year. This is what we want to achieve. And these are, you know, we need to create a campaign to achieve these goals. So then I'll hire an ad agency, you know, there's one called Zig back in the day that did the IKEA campaign, the Start the Car campaign.
Yes.
So they would go to Zig and say, hey, this is what we want to achieve. We want to make an ad for a sale, you know, and we want to make it funny. And so Zig writes a concept down, they get a creative team, and oftentimes creative teams will have to write 50 to 100 ideas.
They must,
You know, and to present. And, you know, some of that gets thrown away internally and some of it's chosen to present. And even when they present, sometimes they have to go back to the table 6, 8, 10 times or more. So then eventually the client will sort of bite on an idea and then...
After like a pitch from
after a
Zig.
Pitch, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes it's, you know, 3, 4 ideas, you know, it's a campaign, you know.
Right.
And then they'll go out, they'll get a producer to go out and start looking for directors. And, you know, there's thousands of directors now globally that direct TV commercials. When I first started, there was maybe 1,000 of us globally that did it. Now
is that right?
Probably 25,000 people that direct commercials globally. It's a much more competitive market.
Yeah.
And so then the way the process typically works is you'll get 3 or 4 directors that get shortlisted.
Okay.
And then those 3 or 4 directors will then do a call with the agency. They'll receive the script.
Okay.
They'll express interest. It has to be mutual. Then you'll do a call where the agency will take the director and the production company that the director's with through the concept. So the point of that is to just make sure that everybody's understanding the concept and where this is going. And it also gives the director the opportunity to ask questions and throw some, you know, typically when I go into a call like that, I've already taken the, you know, over the years I've gotten better at it. You know, I've taken the idea, I've written down my casting notes, I've written my, you know, notes for production design, but more than anything, I've written down notes for storytelling and things that I think might be clever, you know, to whether it's, you know, specific thing that happens in the story or if it's the era that the story happens in or the location that it happens. You know, there's all sorts of things you can manipulate to make the story more interesting. And so you basically come back, you know, you use artistic license to come up with your best version of their idea.
Beautiful.
And so then we, back in the day, would be a few pages. Now it's probably a 30-page document with a written component, visuals, little film clips, all sorts of different things to help you express, you know, sometimes you'll go so far as to storyboard the whole concept.
I was going to say, you must storyboard everything if you want to.
Typically
want to
that happens
level.
When you're in production, but sometimes you'll do it. I remember pitching on a Stella Artois ad years ago and I was really after this concept. So I storyboarded the whole, you know, the whole thing. But so then you basically come back with a really comprehensive set of ideas and a roadmap as to how you see it, because this has to appeal to the agency who's creating the ad, but ultimately the client has to sign off on it and say, yeah, we're good with this vision.
We're on board.
Yeah, we're on board. And sometimes, you know, you're really bold. You know, sometimes you've come up with something that's very, that's quite far off the original idea in terms of certain elements. You know, the core idea is the same, but maybe the way that the story is being told is quite different. So
you have a lot more creative. You actually have a very creative freedom in that space in a beautiful way.
Yeah, in a beautiful way. Yeah. I mean, that is, I think, the sign of a mature director when they can come back with the best version of the idea and mm-hmm. confidently present it. And, you know, and sometimes it doesn't work. You know, sometimes they don't sign off on it. It's too risque for the client yeah. or for the agency, or maybe they feel it misses the mark. But oftentimes if you've done your due diligence and really done your homework and you believe in it, you know,
you can really capture something that needs to be captured at yeah, that time. Yeah. Which is so
you
nice.
Can elevate the idea and bring yeah. it, you know, bring the best version to the table. So, and that's part of the art form.
You bring up the Start the Car IKEA commercial because mm-hmm. I think people just were so shocked in that commercial, just not because of like, there's so much humor behind it. Right.
Yeah.
Did it come out like that in that process? Was it as humorous?
You know what's funny is, so a few of the things I remember about that campaign,
yeah.
honestly,
through the years,
I've talked about it with lots of agencies because, yeah. you know, I've been hired because of that.
Really?
Hired quite a few times yeah. on other
you
campaigns.
You have so many incredible campaigns, but I will say that one, I think it resonates because it hit such a chord with the general public.
Yeah, yeah. I literally can go, I'll be in, you know, Europe and people will say to me, you know, what do you do for a living? I'll tell them and then they'll say, is there anything I would know? And I'll reference that. And it's amazing how many countries around the world, you know, like Australia, I've been in Australia or, you know, I've been in various places and, you know, I mentioned what, and they're like, oh my God, I love that. It's actually the female crowd. It's usually like my mother loves that or my aunt loves that or my sister, you know, like it's
you know, I was thinking yeah. about it the other day. I was thinking, how many languages has that been changed into?
Quite a few.
It would be yeah. so interesting to be like, yeah. how many languages?
Yeah, they've actually done, not with me, unfortunately, but they've redone versions for different markets where they've filmed it in different...
In different places?
Yeah, so different...
Resonated?
Different cast and different language and stuff.
Oh, that's so fun.
But when the original script came through for that, you know, it was a great script. There was an idea at the end of it where the woman dove into the window. So when she got to the car, she dove like headfirst into the window. So yeah. it was quite a bit more broad.
More broad.
And I mean, it's already quite a broad commercial because of her antics when she's walking up. But we did a few things like, you know, I tried to make her, you know, really like just such a character. So when
she's
we cast
such a
it,
character.
Yeah, when we cast it, normally, you know, we'll cast for a day and we'll get 60 actors in or something. And by the end of the day, we'll have somebody that we can pick. And if there's two or three, in that case, there's the husband, there's the main character, the shopper, wife. And then there's person at the cash register.
Yeah.
And so you might get 30 or 40 for each role kind of thing. But we cast first two characters, the husband and the cashier, and the first day. But I didn't find anybody in the first day I liked for her. I had a very specific kind of, I wanted her to be quite theatrical and kind of,
yeah,
you
like
know,
kind of the blonde beehive energy.
Yeah, yeah. And then the second day, they allowed us to do a second day, couldn't find her. And then I said, can we just please do a third day? And I said, can we just focus on people that we don't typically see? I said, you know, can we go to the theater actors in Toronto? And you
oh,
know,
that's
so, we,
so interesting.
So that's what we did. The casting agent went and spoke to all the theater actors in town. And we got about 20 people, you know, to come in. And she was a big time kind of, she did theater in Stratford and in Toronto,
oh, wow.
like, you know, all the big
yeah,
plays.
Yeah, the bigger place.
And she, I can't remember her name. I should know her name, but she was lovely. And she, and you know, and she was just, when she came, I was like, that's it. Like, that's
oh, wow.
the person.
Yeah. So the immediacy of what you saw
yeah,
was there.
Yeah. And so sometimes you have a vision in your head of what you're looking for. And then we did a few things to help her along. Like I remember, I wanted her to walk funny. So I said to the wardrobe stylist, she was wearing like
clunky
heels, like, but low heels.
Yeah.
And so I said, can you cut like a third of one of her heels off so she walks a little wonky, you know? So we cut one of her. So when she's walking, she's sort of like, because, you know, so.
So clever.
Yeah. So little things like that.
Yeah.
That they don't necessarily
make
the whole thing,
it?
But they're part of the fabric of what you end up with, you know? So,
oh.
yeah.
At Oakland Realty, real estate is personal. It's your first home, your next chapter, your biggest decision, and your biggest opportunity. That's why we lead with people first. Trusted advisors, deep local knowledge, and a commitment to doing things right every time. Whether you're buying, selling, or simply planning your future, our agents are here to guide you with clarity, confidence, and care. Because a home isn't just a place you live. It's where life happens. Oakland Realty, inspiring positive change. One person, one home, and one community at a time.
Yeah, that was brilliant. There's so many of your commercials going through. I was like, oh, you're recognized so much. And one thing that just has kind of, you know, I think after doing a deep dive in what you're doing, and because you kind of started as that quirky photographer, knowing your past of that, mm-hmm. it makes complete sense. Like there's a lot of that vision of like being able to, it's so memorable, right?
Right.
In what you're doing. You've worked with so many agencies and some of them take bigger risks. Some of them don't take bigger risks. What are you finding? Like, what do you think makes them trust you early on as a director? And
well, I mean, I think some of it is purely the real. You know, mm-hmm. I think that the real shows what you're capable of and what you've done in the past. So a lot of clients want to see it on the real. You know, if an ad agency's come up with a concept, they want a director that's done something similar enough that they can kind of envision it. You know, it's kind of, I mean, in real estate,
yeah,
it's like,
thing.
You know, it's like people, yeah. you know, some people have a vision and some people need to see it, you know, a house staged, you know?
That's right.
So I guess a reel is like, you know, showing them the staged version of,
yeah,
of what you do. But, and then a lot of it is the production company you're with and the reputation of the directors that are at the production company and how, you know, historically they've, you know, how professional they are and how well they've done. But, you know, from a personal level, I think it's, you know, it all starts in the initial call with the agency when you're presenting your concept and your idea. And I think they want to see that you have belief in the concept and you have a very strong understanding of where this idea is going. They don't want you to be wishy-washy. You know, they don't want you to kind of wing it on the day. They want a plan. They want a plan of attack. You know, and they want execution, you know. So because really at the end of the day, what you're doing when you're shooting is you're still getting raw, it sounds strange, but you're still getting raw materials on that day, because then, you know, you've got to go back and, you know, you've got to edit this thing, you know, and you've got to add music. So the IKEA thing, for example, like we added a really quirky, like dun-dun, it almost sounds like the Jaws soundtrack, you know. It's like, and there's a Ted Rosnick who ended up, you know, being a very famous kind of music
producer
yeah. in the industry. He did the music for that. And so it's like all of the elements, the editing, the music. I mean, and the edit's huge, right? You can imagine, like, you can change the order around of things and it all, you know, it all has an impact. So and you're, as the director, traditionally, and it's, clients are getting more and more involved these days.
Are
you
they?
Know, yeah.
Yeah.
But traditionally you're the captain of the ship, you know, even now you still are. It's just, there's more, sometimes things, they die by committee. You know, sometimes you'll have a really good idea and a really strong set of material that you present, and then it goes into the edit and everybody wants their needs met. Like I remember doing a campaign for Vicks and we shot it in South Africa and we were there for, I think, 6 weeks, and it was very rapid fire cuts. It was all about, you can imagine, Vicks, cold and cough.
Cold and cough, yeah.
So it was all these different, very quick vignettes, but it was meant to be all over the world. So we made, you know, we obviously used, you know, the craft sometimes to, you know, we're shooting in South Africa, we made it look like Japan and Sweden and, you know, you know, India. I mean, we, downtown Cape Town, we dressed, you know, what this one section, we dressed it to feel like a market in Mumbai, you know, we had 50 extras and all these different, you know, so there's always things like that going on, but you're trying to get somewhere and you can imagine that the edit, you know, it
must be just,
yeah, it's a huge process in that particular case. Like Vicks is global. So, you know, the Japanese Vicks clients wanted it this way and the English Vicks clients, you know, so they ended up doing like 30 different edits kind of thing. They all turned out great, but you can just imagine, you know, that there's just lots of cooks in the kitchen. So, and sometimes, you know, the work you do gets better and sometimes it's diluted, you know, so that can be challenging, but that's kind of part of, I think in some ways, good clients often understand that they've hired professionals to do this and they, you know, sit back and let them,
you know,
do their work and then, you know, have some input. And I think that maybe some less mature clients sometimes get their hands in there too soon. You know, it's like, let's, let's create the thing and then taste it. You know what I mean?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've been taken all over the world to like really experience different cultures, but also just that side of production. How big are these crews that you're going with? I think a lot of people see things like a big production of a movie and they're like filming in one or two of their homes. Can it be like a slim group of people that are just, or is it better? Like, what's better?
Well, it really depends on the story. So like, I was just talking to, I just signed with a new production company in Toronto called Skin and Bones. So we were just having this conversation earlier today, but there was a commercial I did last year that everybody saw during the Blue Jays run.
Okay.
For the World Series. So it's George Springer and he's at TD Bank.
I totally know this. Yes.
So
that was so good.
Oh, thank you.
And she really wanted him to come over.
Yeah. So that's, it's a small cast, it's just two people. It's the banker and George Springer. So, in that case, it's all about casting, a charismatic banker. Like when she plays this kind of nervous person who's trying to get all the autographs from him and that's really, she's trying to play it cool, but she's obviously getting the autographs for herself or her family or friends. But, in that case, you've got a crew of 40 or 50 people around, lighting technicians, camera technicians, hair and makeup, wardrobe, all these different things. And then you've got your cast. And, in that particular one, it's some of the challenges, like George has a stutter, actually. I remember talking to him and sort of sitting down with him and saying, hey, like, listen, don't sweat it. Like, this is film. Like, we can edit around. You can stutter halfway through your sentence and just take a pause and keep going and it'll be fine. So there's little things like that that can have an impact, but that's actually not your question. But
I love that insight.
but it all depends on how many people you extras. Like, I shot a commercial in Buenos Aires for 7Up and it was called Beware the Heat. So it was a guy who's literally trying to get away from the rays of sun that are beating down on him on a hot day. And so he starts to kind of run away and you see him like, it's almost like a Bond film, he's running down the street and he's, gets on a bus and runs through the bus and tries to find a pool, but the pool's empty because it's dried up from the heat. And
oh my goodness.
Excuse me. And all these different things are happening. And in the end, he ends up, sitting down at the side of a road, just hot and sweaty, and a 7-Up truck goes by and takes the corner too fast and four cases fall off and they all break, but one bottle rolls up to him and it's like this refreshing, 7-Up. And he opens it and that sort of thing. But that I remember we had in the street scenes, I think we had upwards of 200 extras, and it was like a feature film and we had an entire block and a half all, cordoned off to do this commercial. We had cranes and we had cameras on three or four different buildings. We had cameras attached to the side of chase vehicles. And we had, bigger stories require more people, more gear, more money, more time. So often when we go to Cape Town or we go to Buenos Aires, it's cheaper to produce there.
Okay.
Talent's cheaper. So for instance, in Buenos Aires, one of the things was we knew we could get those 200 extras for kind of like $50
a day.
Kind of thing. In the US, they'd be getting 300 a day plus two meals plus overtime. And
tons.
So, there's strange things that factor in. Like, I think eventually, we used to shoot in Brazil a lot, but in Brazil, they ended up creating a union for all the actors and all the extras and stuff. And so it became much more expensive to shoot there. And literally overnight, like, production just stopped going there because it was no longer
affordable.
So, which is,
do you find that it's kept happening more and more in Canada because of that, like being in doing these commercials and they're being brought up here because of the dollar, or is it still
It is a positive for Canada. Like Canada, as I said, there's a sort of natural discount built in because of the, the exchange rate and there's still a strong production facility in Vancouver and Toronto. So, you also want to go places where, all of the support staff is there. If you need stuntmen and you need animals, that are going to be in the scene, or you need special effects, all those things,
They're all there.
Yeah, they're all there. So you need a little bit of that. Like, Mexico City has become a popular place to shoot because the, production facilities have become better and better over the years. So it's fascinating.
It's so funny you say that because I just recently was mentioning that I know people that are, they were like, oh, Morgan, you should put your house on
as a location.
As a location. I was like, I'll do that. That sounds like good. And I didn't realize it was one guy in this city that runs this whole, like, this one guy.
Dave Pink?
Dave Pink.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine.
You better tell Dave, highlight mine, okay? Yeah, yeah. But I said, Dave Pink is the guy. Yeah, he's the guy that everybody...
There's actually multiple companies, I'm sure, but he's definitely one of the more successful
guys at
location
Bassett.
Scouts.
And then he said to
managers.
Me, just send it to me in an email. And I was like, I'm going to. But it is nice when you know where you're shooting, right? And you have people like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That are in those spaces. Now, you have often been described as the actor's director. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. What do you see in people that you think many directors are missing? Well, that IKEA.
Yeah, that IKEA. I mean, obviously, you know, as a director, you want to look for unique traits. And so I think I'm always looking for that. But I lived in England as a kid. Both my parents are British. So that British humor, that sensibility, that kind of dry humor has always appealed to me. And I like subtlety. So a lot of the ideas, like a lot of the concepts I've worked on in terms of campaigns and, you know, comedy pieces in particular, like they're quite broad as an idea, but I like to execute them in a way that leaves you thinking, oh, that was so clever. You know, like that was, you know, like, oh, that's clever. You know, there's a little wink to humor, you know, but the overall takeaway is, oh, that's clever. Like, I love that, you mm-hmm. know? So I would say people that have good instincts in that regard, like for me, when I go into it, like a lot of the work's done in the casting room for me, like mm-hmm. when I'm working with actors and you've got the script and, you know, we'll workshop things, you know, I'll say, try saying it this way. Or, you know, what if you know, the classic is, you know, like, let's, you know, do one bigger, do one smaller, you know, like, you know, in terms of the energy or the whatever they're telegraphing, you know, you're trying to get a variety of different deliveries so you can understand mm-hmm. if on the day you want to try something different, can this actor pivot with you and execute, you know?
But that's a good, you know, point.
Strong actors will have strong instincts. And I often say this to people, you know, like really, like I'm talking, you know, feature film actors and really, you know, very successful actors, the Leonardo DiCaprios or the Meryl Streeps or the, mm-hmm. you know, whoever it is of the world, they're really intelligent people. Like it's, I think mm-hmm. it's lost on the public sometimes how intelligent actors often are because yes, they've got to memorize the lines. That's the first thing. First of all, that's not easy.
Just so you know, I've done speeches and I'm still trying to do them. It is hard.
Yeah. And you can tell like an actor, even an actor that's got a good memory has got a leg up on the average person because somebody that comes into an audition and they've got the script memorized to the point where you can give them feedback and they can pivot because they know the script.
Oh.
Whereas you'll get some people that are so nervous that you'll give them very specific feedback after their first take or two. And it will just come back exactly the same because even though they're hearing the feedback, what they're actually doing is just thinking, please God, let me remember the lines, you know, and it just comes out exactly the same way. So, and that's an extreme example, but back to my point, I think that, you know, actors that, you know, really can be insightful about human nature and the human condition and how do I react to what the other actor is giving me? And like, you know, what is the, you know, the core idea that the story is trying to convey and, you know, and how do you, you know.
What's that foresight? Like, I think they have such foresight for these actors. Yeah. But you finding them is also just, I think, a big part of like acting. From what friends that are actors and people, it is, you know, you already have such a vision in your mind for these mm-hmm. for these people that are going to be able to storytell this whole commercial or this whole production mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah.
Having the know-how is, I guess what you're saying is so important is finding the right people to fit the puzzle mm-hmm. within mm-hmm. the whole thing.
Yeah.
Tell me, like, I mean, all your, back to that whole thing about you and your comedy, it's so subtle. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the British, but it doesn't shout, right? Like it doesn't shout, that's which is idea. So clever. Yeah. You know, like, I guess, is it your creativity or is it just that British side of you? Like, what do you like to, what makes you excited? What movies are you watching that are funny that you're like, oh, that's funny?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, Marty Supreme's out. I don't know if you've seen it.
I know.
It. That was phenomenal.
Someone came up to me and said it was a 9 out of 10.
You know, I think that it probably exactly what we're talking about. It's a little bit subtle. And it's a big story.
It's a big story.
But it doesn't hit you over the head with, you know, it's not broad. It's, you know, there's a lot of moments in the story that are kind of subtle. But, you know, I just watched a film last night. I think it's called Goodbye June.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Did you see it?
No, but one of my really good friends was like, Morgan, you need to watch this.
Yeah. An example of...
Has Tamar seen it?
Actors being, you know, clever people. Kate Winslet directed it.
Oh.
And she's featured in it.
Brilliant.
It's such a deep dive into families. And talk about, you know, the human condition. This is like, there's so many universal truths in this film. Like when you're watching it, you're just, you know, things are happening between the siblings and between the parents and the kids. And you can't help but just, you know, you're in your head. You're like, oh my God, I totally know that moment. Or I've totally, you know, I've seen that in my family or other families or those sorts of things. So there's so many films through the years. I'm a cinephile to the core, but I just love good storytelling, you know, and there's every year there's a slew of them. I mean, as a director, I'm part of the Directors Guild of America. Yeah, so we get screeners every year. They used to FedEx them to us, like 50 of them a year out of this big stack. Now there's an app that we use and we get them and, you know, we have to sign an agreement that we're not going to share them and stuff because we're seeing them sometimes before they're released. And ultimately that goes into a pool where, you know, our vote goes towards the Oscars. Like the DGA has some votes, sort of thing. So, you know, and every year I'm amazed, you know, there's 10, 15 films that are just, you know, jaw-droppingly
incredible.
Good. Yeah. So
yeah, the Marty Supreme, it's so funny you say that because everyone knows he's going to win now. Because you go through the award ceremony and I'm like, what about Leonardo?
Right, right.
Well, I just want Leonardo to win,
you know,
once.
You never know, though. Sometimes there's a surprise when you get to the Oscars. I mean, yeah. But I would say, you know, I love... You know, I'm a comedy director, so mm-hmm. I love great comedies. I also love dramatic films and that sort of thing.
A mix of them both. Do you ever worry that it's going to be maybe not understood, or do you go through the process because?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you missed.
We did a spot called Hockey Canada Hand.
Okay.
And it was a story that was told in reverse chronological order. So you start with an old man, and he's in a retirement home. He's playing solitaire and his hands are kind of shaking as he's playing solitaire. And his one hand is like quite dirty, you know, obviously dirty.
Yes.
And then you go back and it's the same man and he's now in the last day at his office. You know, he's kind of packing up his, you know, he's clearly worked in this office for years and he's packing up the box with all of his
belongings
and leaving. And as he's, you know, leaving, you know, you see his phone's kind of dirty and you see that there's various objects around the room. And even when he flips off the light switch, you know, it's kind of stained and you can see his dirty hand. And then, you know, you go back and there's all of these situations where, you know, he's teaching his son to ride a bike. And as he pushes his son on the back to, you know, there's a hand mark on the back of the son, you know,
like dirty.
Yeah. Dirty. And then you go back to when he's in school and he's swimming down the swim team kind of swims by and, you know, now we're kind of like in the 60s, you know, we've gone back 10 years at a time. So now we're, you know, we're back in the 60s kind of thing. And he's got this hand with a bag over it and he's swimming, you know, you're thinking like, what the heck is going on? And then eventually you get back to a hockey arena and there's all the players, the Red Wings are coming out of the change room and Gordie Howe's walking towards camera, you know, and it's, you know, the 50s and it's all beautiful and, you know, like that kind of vintage feel. And all these people are kind of hanging over the side and this one little kid, you know, like, you know, you can imagine trying to get a signature, whatever, you know, reaches out and Gordie Howe just happens to look and reaches up and shakes the kid's hand, you know, and then the kid kind of after he shakes Gordie's hand, he just like looks at his hand, like he just stares at his hand and you realize that,
oh my God,
he's never washed his hand for the rest of his life. So we've watched the story in reverse chronological order. So, you know, when we first edited it, you know,
okay.
I would say like 80% of people got it and thought it was amazing. And 20% of the people would just have that look on their face like,
what? I don't get it.
Like, what? You know, like dirty hand, you know, and then they would kind of cotton on. And there was a big debate because, you know, a couple of the people at the agency were like, you know, we can't air this. Like some people aren't getting it. And then we were like, but talk to the people who get it. Like they love it. And like, you know, so... And sometimes it's, you know, you have to kind of speak to the higher order in a sense of like your audience is has to do some work sometimes. You know, you've got to do something that pushes them or kind of, so that's one example. But I mean, I think that.
And building off of that is, it's the integrity of your work too, right? Mm-hmm. Like how are you putting up these frames as a director to say, okay, this is something I'm really happy with. I don't really want to move off of this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you ever get to that point where the customer is like, I don't want to use it?
Well, yeah, this is what I was talking about earlier, where sometimes things die by committee because you present an edit that you really believe in. I mean, I think in feature films, you know, I think you have more latitude that way to kind of have an artistic vision and kind of like stick to it and say, like, this is my craft and this is how I want to present it. And, you know, and hopefully the audience likes it. Whereas, you know, when you're dealing with commercial work, obviously the first audience is going to be the ad agency and the client, and they have to say, yeah, we love it. Like, we're ready to send this out into the world. And, you know, and you hope that you get a IKEA start the car, or you get a spot that's, you know, that
the
everyone...
TV commercial that I'm obsessed
with. Or, you know, whatever it might be, right? That everybody loves. So it's, and that's the challenge in being a commercial director is from start to finish, sometimes you're talking about maybe 8 weeks, 5 weeks sometimes if it's in a rush. So, you know, from that initial concept on a piece of paper to, you know, getting into the editing room and, you know, shooting the film, getting in the editing room and doing all the post work. So
it's such a process, and it's amazing. And I think what the audience is going to hear from you today is that length of time. You know, I think people think, oh yeah, especially with what's happening with technology, a lot of, you know, this is something I really wanted to ask you about, which is your thoughts on, you know, just how that's changing. Like, of course, everyone, in my mind, I think storytelling is always going to stand in the test of time, because to your point, they could be years and years ago and this one ad from Nike just hit you so hard and it's with you. But now everything's really going that short form. Like, a lot of the younger generation is not as driven on that. Do you think that's changing at all, or do you think it's the same?
I mean, I guess there's two questions there.
Yeah.
Technology and then...
And if the world is...
If the attention span is going... I'll start with the second one. Apparently, there's a whole trend of these like micro series that are happening. Apparently, they're very big in Asia. They're kind of like minute long or minute and a half long episodes. And then you might have 10 of them or, you know, 20 of them, whatever it might be for a particular brand. So like, I don't know whether it would be...
Like Dior or something.
Yeah, I was
going to
say
that.
Gucci or Prada or whoever, you know, Dior... And so, you know, and the idea there would be to like have a captive, you know, create a captive audience that's interested in your story. And then you've got product placement that happens to be, you know, relatable to your audience, you know, and of interest to people. So that's, you know, that's
a whole thing.
Yeah, that's a whole thing.
And the influencers that are kind of like, it's funny, some of the commercials you don't even see sometimes. And now the influencers are having so much influence on people seeing those commercials. Like there's like a whole new kind of world on the, I mean, I'm a millennial, so I'm a little older than some of these new Gen Z groups. But are you finding that it's, you know, like really great storytelling, really great commercials are still... like really what agencies are looking for?
I do. I mean, even with like, you know, when you mentioned technology, I wasn't sure if you were going to bring up AI or any of those things, but I think that ultimately like storytelling as a craft is like, it's not going to go away. I mean, whether you've got real actors or whether you've got, you know, AI produced actors, or you still have to have a great idea. You have to have, you know, the story has to make sense. I mean, the craft has to be impeccable, you know, whether it's the casting or the locations or the, you know, so all of those elements have to be executed in a way that's, you know, it's spot on, you know, you have to nail those things. So I think that technology, like right now, what I'm seeing is that AI is really working well for helping us to present our ideas to the agency and the client to show them what we're going to do.
Oh, great.
So we kind of can, you know, help them to pre-visualize.
Mm.
So it's not so much of a surprise on the day. Or just to take the guessing out of the equation. So that's, you know, that's
really
a part.
Good.
Yeah, that's a part. And then, you know, I'm sure, you know, at some stage, I mean, you know, ads will be completely AI. I mean, some have been presented. I think Coca-Cola did a big ad in Europe this year that was presented, and then they had to pull it off the air because there was a big backlash against it because people
were not ready.
You know, they just didn't want a fully AI ads. But, you know, at some point they'll become, you won't be able to distinguish between the two. I mean, I guess the, you know, But back to the, you know, notion of storytelling, like that just doesn't go away. I mean, good storytelling is,
you know,
it's
in everything. I think it's the one thing that resonates so deeply in people's hearts and minds. And And even for myself, watching even influencers, it's funny talking to these, looking at all the influencers, looking at it, they're almost like making little mini commercials to your point and telling stories.
Yeah.
I don't think storytelling is going to go away anywhere. And I think more companies are still looking for something that resonates home, that feeling for the brand.
Yeah.
But the question will be, the next phase of that is, will it heavily go into AI eventually? I mean, could, but I think it might go into, it's not going to ever take the movie. And it depends on what brand it is. I think there always will be an essence to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which, well, people, good. I mean, authenticity is a, you know, in the last few years has been a big buzzword in our industry. I mean, I think people want authenticity to, a, you know, to a large degree when they're being sold something, you know? But yeah, that's a...
That's so amazing. I mean, I could talk to you forever, but I want one last couple of things. I'm like, I'm like, I'm holding up your time.
No problem.
You know, for anyone that's kind of early in their career, I mean, who feels quite invincible, that wants to make some big moves. We're talking a lot about in 2026, specifically in your industry, directing, producing, whether that's just in some level of creativity. What piece of advice could you give them on your side, just with so much of your knowledge of jumping into some of their goals for moving forward? What's helped you, I guess? Maybe there's like, what's given you the gas to get you to where you are right now?
The first thing that comes to mind is, as I mentioned, I didn't have a formal education in photography or film. I mean, I did go to university and I did study and, you know, and studied acting and things like that. But I think that just don't be afraid to jump in, you know, and give it a try. Like, I can remember in particular when I was a photographer, I can remember, you know, getting these campaigns, you know, sort of 2 or 3 months into my photo, you know, once I'd finished assisting and I was now getting my own authentic clients. And just, you know, waking up and thinking, oh my God, like, how am I going to do this today? Like, I don't know. You know, I know what I want to do. I just don't know if I can do it. And I think that we often surprise ourselves in the sense that, you know, you, once you actually go and try, you know, you can pull it off, you know, and it might, you know, it might not be easy. You know, you might have to, you know, take a few swings at it, but you'll, you know, you'll get there. And I think that, you know, that adage about, you know, like, failure is just, you know, it's just something along the way to success. So, I mean, it's, you know, you're going to fail a few times, but that's okay. And, you know, you just, you know, especially these days, there's so many, you know, in particular with filmmaking or any creative endeavor, there's so many tools out there. You can just, you know, just go out and start creating, like, just try, like, have an idea, have a concept, you know, of, you know, photographers, you know, they always talk about, you know, self-assigning a project, you know, just say like, hey, I want to do a project about X, Y, or Z, you know, whatever it might be. So
you guys are just, I mean, in another level for me, because I've got this business, I have the business creative side, but for photography and film, you have to have such an eye. Like, I truly believe that. What is your kind of overall thoughts of the future of the world that you're living in? Tell me a little bit about that.
The world as a filmmaker,
living you is a big one.
No, I think that, as I said, the tools are changing.
Yeah,
they're more readily available. The diversity of what you can do is expanding rapidly in terms of, you know, if you want a scene now with thousands of characters and things collapsing, you know, that all of that's manageable. And I think that it's back to what we said. I think that storytelling is like it's a universal, not a truth, but it's a skill that won't change. You know, it's that gift of being a good storyteller, it goes unchanged, you know? And I think the way that you tell the story may change and the tools that you use may change. But I think ultimately it's like a great story, a great idea, execute, you know, and the ability to kind of curate your own, you know, you've got all these tools you can utilize, but, you know, if you use the wrong tool in the wrong way, or you're not very discerning about where you want to get to, the story won't be well told, you know?
No.
So I think it's just, you know, it's a continuation of, like, you know, storytelling as being the core element, a good idea, and like paying homage to that idea at any cost, you know, like that's where you need to get to.
Oh. Mark, thank you so much for being on Get On Top. I literally could talk to you for another 4 hours, but I'd be like, let's go eat something. Well, you just have given us so much. And I know that everyone that's listening is just going to be, is such a fan, just like myself.
Well, thank you.
And we're excited to see what the next phase is of yourself and all the projects you're putting out. We'll be watching.
Absolutely. Yay. Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Get On Top. Don't miss out on more incredible stories by rating, reviewing, and following our podcast on your platform of choice. Remember to tag us on social media at Get On Top Podcast. Until next time, keep climbing, keep striving, and always remember, the view is worth it from the top.
This podcast is produced and edited by Podfather Creative.